Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do. From Namibia, Africa, and around the world, tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Good Monday afternoon and welcome to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. The world is about to go up in flames, but we do not care. We're just here to talk about Africa. And on today's menu, we have Algeria. But before we get to Algeria and, it's a full attack amendment-wise on its constitution basically, they made a lot of changes in that constitution. My question is, they got their independence in 1962. Why now?
Okay, here's the weirdest thing. There's a reason why I shared also the script document with you with the resources.
Yeah.
I found two, I won't call them dodgy, but I was trying to look for the actual foundational document that started this process.
Yeah.
So in 1999, when the AU was still the OAU, the heads of state went and said, and this is called the Algiers Declaration, we have to contest and we have to literally try to right the wrongs of colonialism on Africa and its people that it had suffered. Now, countries like South Africa, countries like Algeria, countries like, who else is there? Egypt is the worst example.
What's the example on?
Of colonialism. The British were there, the French were there. The British and the French fought over Egypt.
Yeah, when you talk about Egypt, Egypt have been on the receiving end of a lot of colonial expansions. Both colonial, imperial, whatever you want to call it, they've gotten it.
And even when you think about ancient Roman, during the period, that ancient period when the Romans and the ancient Greeks also existed.
One of the most famous battles. Between the Romans and the Carthaginians.
And where were the Carthaginians?
Oh boy.
Where were they based? It's in modern day Tunisia.
Yeah, Tunisia.
Tunisia / Libya. Algeria was another sort of like ancient, civilization back then before it became Algeria. But it's primarily at the heart of this discussion. So we are talking about obviously late colonialism. That particular period, which Namibia also experienced, which was here from the 1800s coming in this direction.
Yeah.
But it's primarily because of 1999 when the declaration of the Algiers declaration was founded. Now, I thought, Helmut, because on the 1st of December last year, 30th November last year, 30 November, 1st December, those 2 days, The Algerian government on another document cites that heads of state came together for a specific engagement on that 2-day situation. It's hosted on the Algerian embassy website to Baku. Baku is in, I think, Azerbaijan.
Yeah, Azerbaijan.
And they make mention and reference to this document. So I've had to go and find the actual foundational document that literally says or gives power to this discussion, which also gives power to the theme of last year. So in between also, so if you don't know, dear listeners, on the 25th of December last year, the Algerian government, okay, not the Algerian, the Algerian lawmakers, the upper house and the lower house, they also have a national council and a national assembly like ours, but they call it different names. It's got like a different assembly of names. But it's literally the same thing. So the upper house and the lower house of the Algerian, legislature voted and agreed upon bringing into life an act, a piece of law that criminalizes colonialism and literally that they try to correct what France has caused on Algeria. And this includes, the various methods in terms of the damages that France has caused. But here's a caveat, Helmut. Let me first also put the caveat in there.
Yeah.
In 2024, the Algerian president, Tebboune.
Not attempting.
Because there's a Y in there somewhere. I didn't know if I had to read it as Tebboune or Tebboune. So Tebboune had stated in an address in 2024, meaning the year before, last year, that Algeria doesn't seek financial reparations. They're not seeking money, not in US dollars, not in euros. But it is the particular sort of like damage of colonialism that they're trying to correct. So, to set the record straight, how did Algeria get into the colonialism discussion? And I did this talk yesterday, but not of Algeria, but just to show it was a formation of a military unit in France that we know today was literally the agenda of the French king in 1830 to literally start, you know, to firstly achieve some sort of national pride, and all that kind of stuff, you know, to try and lift national morale in France. And one of it was to get a new African colony, and one of those African colonies.
So the best way to boost your country's morale is colonial expansion?
Yes.
Jeez, okay.
Which makes, and this is literally before the Berlin Conference.
Yeah.
Because in 1830, the literal existence of the French Foreign Legion is literally tied to the colonization of Algeria. The French Foreign Legion was constituted to literally go and firstly help in managing and policing French African colonial territories.
Yeah.
And secondly, to literally go and start a colonial campaign in Algeria. Now, history, obviously, from the French perspective, would argue that they built up. And you would read some of those historical things. I even watched the movie, based upon, it was a movie that was made in the 70s or the 60s. And if you would hear from the French sentiment, you know, the Frenchmen, they were saying, but they were literally saying Algeria is ours because they built Algeria. If you had to look at what Algeria looked like back then,
yeah,
in the 60s,
yeah,
before the independence, or you know, as the independence, you know, resistance began, Algeria looked like a cut out of Mediterranean France. It was designed, laid out just like Mediterranean France,
yeah,
meaning like Marseille or the other places. And Algeria is pretty big.
Isn't like Algeria like the biggest?
It is now the biggest,
right?
Yeah, because after South Sudan split from Sudan,
yeah,
Algeria was big, got that label.
Yeah.
And then follows, I think, Libya, and then follows
DRC.
Yeah. So Algeria's particular history is literally tied to the existence of the French Foreign Legion. The French Foreign Legion was made up of former Swiss reserves that fought in North Italian campaign, specifically as the French obviously had to intervene when the Italians were trying to become Italy as we know Italy today.
Yeah.
So this king of France, Louis Philippe, did not know, you know, what to do because he was getting an influx of migrants because of that war. He was getting he obviously sat with soldiers that...
Wait, the Swiss-Italian one? Which war now did you send the immigrant flux into France?
Okay, so the things that the European politicians today are complaining about
immigrants.
Of Syrian immigrants, of North African and Central African immigrants to their flocking to their shores are literally based upon a development of what has been existent in history throughout human history.
Political
instability, wars, the likes. They even spelling that potentially there would be a mass outflow of Iranians into heading once again to Europe, and everyone is once again asking the question, why would you start a war which literally makes you suffer the exact thing that you keep complaining about? Now, which is obviously what Donald Trump started. It's what some of the European countries, they don't know where they stand on it.
Yeah.
Because they are accepting Ukrainian refugees, but they don't want to accept refugees from other places.
No, it's very, look, that war is very easy to start if you are Israel or the U.S. Because, especially if you're the, I mean, if you're the U.S., because, well, you are halfway across the planet. You have the Atlantic, yeah, you have the Atlantic Ocean in between you and the country you're bombing. So it's much difficult for the immigrants, you know, they can get there, but it's much more difficult compared to getting in any of the European countries, both East and West.
Indeed, indeed. The other sort of like drawback situation that happened during the 1800s was obviously this was also a period where, Europe had a lot of wars going on in Europe. So there was a lot of migrational movement. So Louis Philippe decided, you know what? Let me constitute, let me look for a new outway, an outlet of a way. The outlet meant go and start another colonial campaign in Africa. What does this mean? Constitute another military unit because he had all these foreigners. Yeah. And the French army, obviously, back then in Europe, the European armies were very strong on homogeneity. So what do I mean? Everyone looked the same. Everyone spoke the same language and everyone had a French cultural perspective. Louis Philippe decided, since I've got all these refugees and these migrants and these Swiss mercenary units that he hired for the Italian campaign, why not constitute something, you know, with these people?
Yeah.
And boom, voila. They get shipped off. He starts this unit. This unit goes and fights literally and goes and subdues, you know, the locals in Algeria. Algerian resistance had begun since then for 100 years. But they had, okay, not for 100 years completely because by 1900 or something like that, the last tribal resistance was literally squashed. By the, once again, the French Foreign Legion as well. So, Algeria has a unique story to tell. Just like Namibia also has its own unique story to tell. Namibia's story is still, if we look at it, Helmut, it's still an unexplored story, primarily because besides the books that I've bought and that I still want to finish reading, it's unique situations, for example, how the Orange River discussion between Namibia and South Africa is a nuanced one.
Elephant in the room.
Which is an elephant in the room, but guess where the South Africans got that, if I can call it, audacity? They got it from the British. So, after the Berlin Conference, and the Germans actually said reluctantly, you know, Otto von Bismarck reluctantly said, okay, fine. We'll go for something in Africa. Nobody wanted Togo. The French and the British didn't want Togo, so the Germans took Togo. People were still undecided about Tanzania. The Germans took Tanzania, and then there was us. However, when the Germans decided, you know, when things popped off here in Southwest Africa, which is now Namibia, the British had done one thing. They had already had, they were on the verge, or they had just had the first of the Anglo-Boer Wars. This was when the, what was it, two or three, Dutch settler republics. You had the Orange Free State and there was another one, that had existed. The one of, I almost said Ampingtonia, but that was someone else. But this one was closely positioned here to the Botswana-Namibia border. When the British obviously had finished with their engagements with the local settler, other settler groups, that were trying to have some format of autonomy, the British went and decided and they told the Germans, the river is ours. So South Africa's audacity in this discussion comes through from a colonial perspective. Meaning, when the Germans got here in Southwest Africa, the British were already saying, the river is ours.
Yeah.
Now, this makes things tricky, obviously.
So, after the Germans were you know, the Germans were kicked out, and then Southwest Africa was given to South Africa as a protectorate. Then they decided, okay, you know what, change your plans. The river is ours.
Or we stick to what we got after before 1921, before the mandate kicked in. So, yeah, the river still stays ours. But we're still on Nigeria. We're still on Algeria, not Nigeria. Nigeria is also just as nuanced, ne? Because of the British. Because literally the British obliterated a civilization. The Benin, the Kingdom of Benin. Which is today, it's one of the Nigerians don't have provinces, they have states.
They have states, yeah.
The Benin
That's
state.
A very big landmass.
Yeah, it is. I mean, 200 million people. How are you going to say province? And each province probably has like, you know, a couple of 30 million.
Yeah.
Just rolling about there. But the British, still till the day, are probably one of the worst sort of like people in the colonial discussion. Now, getting back to the Algerian discussion. So, as of today as well, Algeria and France are talking, even though Algeria and France has, their relationship is, you know.
Oh, it's very rocky.
Has fallen so low.
Yeah.
Okay, do you know what is one of the other nuances currently right now? So Algeria had locked up a French sports journalist since 2024, for supposedly glorifying terrorism. That is his accusation.
Is that according to their new constitution or?
This is in 2024.
So their new constitution only came to effect last year.
Well, it's actually just a new piece of law. It's not a full-on constitution, the way I'm reading it.
It was a constitutional amendment.
Yeah.
They didn't build one from scratch.
Yeah. So it seems like this guy, this journalist, this Christophe Glaize, has been in prison, in Algerian prison since 2024. Mm. He was there to cover a Algerian league match, a top league match, and homeboy has been, for some reason, he was supposedly something he said or something he read, or something he did, and he's been in incarceration, ever since. Now the French and the Algerians are negotiating about his release and this particular discussion. However, here's the concern, Helmut. The French journalist somehow, because obviously it's Algeria. I didn't see in any of the, for example, like Le Monde's report and the other report, RFI report, the other online publication, primarily whether or not the constitutional amendment is somehow being worked into the negotiations between the French minister, Laurent Nunez, and his counterpart from Algeria, the Saoud, the minister by the name of Saoud, whether or not they're actually trying to mend something over so as to soften the language of the said particular constitutional amendment. But then here's the other update that came up literally, I think at the start of this year, or just a couple of days or a couple of weeks ago, is that what is our National Assembly, the similar entity, is now seeking to soften some articles of the constitutional amendment of the act.
Yeah.
They're trying to soften some of the articles, so as to say, because the guys that are the National Council of Algeria, they literally went and stipulated some sort of a reparational mechanism for France to literally feel sorry for the 132 years of colonialism.
Yeah, except last time I checked, France has acknowledged, but they have not apologized. They have not offered a formal apology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it makes things nuanced. So in a nutshell, I summarized as much as I could from a whole bunch of documents. Just so that we have, like, what's the current situation,
yeah,
where did it build up from, and where it's heading to.
Look, Algeria, like any country, has its own positives and negatives in terms of what's going on in its political sphere, and this is both domestic and foreign policy. They're also engaged in some kind, their dispute with Morocco over the Western Sahara part. Theirs is more tense than the whole. Namibia, South Africa, Orange River discussion. Because Algeria has been supporting the entity that's sort of like that wants I think Algeria's point of view is that, it's part of theirs. Yeah. It's part of their country.
Yeah.
Except Morocco has been supporting, Western Sahara's autonomy, if you can call it that. Now, in 2024, I believe the French sided with Morocco in that support of Western Sahara's autonomy, and the Algerians did not like that. As you'd expect.
Which is also another nuance.
The Algerians obviously were like you would expect any country. Well, they wouldn't like that. You'd get the same reaction if you'd go to, to Taiwan and say recognize the Taiwanese government. You'll get the same reaction if you were to go to places like Guam, for example, and tell them, or Hawaii. And you tell them that, you guys have the right to govern yourself. The U.S. would be pissed.
Mm.
And every country has this area that is more of a tense issues, both in discussion and basically also in allocation as to where does it really belong.
Yeah.
Now.
And Hawaii.
Hawaii. Just bring up Hawaii and you'll ruffle a lot of feathers in American politics. And now for Britain, how much time do you have? Just find any island. we're not even going to talk about the British because they have a lot of independent, so quote unquote sovereign islands that is a part of them all at the same time scattered across the planet.
And some of them are registered supposedly as territories, but when you go there, there's not even a lighthouse or even a corrugated iron shack there to say there's someone living there because there's just birds and
it's
plants.
It's easy way of laundering money.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there are a lot of beds on those islands that own a lot of money. Now,
supposedly.
One thing that you see here is that the French have acknowledged that, what we have done was bad. And we are talking about, 130 plus years later. And offering a formal apology, that's where the French government basically now have been dragging their feet.
Yeah.
When you look at it from that angle, and you look at the amendments, so that's the first document that you shared, the amendments that were made, I'm going through that thing and I can't help but go like, this thing should have been illegal from 1962.
It should have been. It should have been illegal the day of 1991, the 1st of December.
Yeah.
1st of December 1990, not 1991, 1999. Here's the thing, Helmut. As I now obviously went and, looked for these documents that are being mentioned and you try to source, okay. What's the foundation for Algeria's claim? We, even including Namibia, went and said yes, because it's heads of state who went and said yes to this particular Algiers declaration regarding colonialism and colonialism, slavery, and apartheid, that, reparations and all those other particular mechanisms should...
We all have that one thing only we do. That unique thing that makes you real. Just like Vintage Beer.
For some, it's that secret handshake thing that makes you feel like family. For others, it's that brave hold my beer thing when the moment calls for courage. For friends, it's that fun podcast and cooler box thing where the best memories are made.
And for Vintage Beer, it's that barley, hops, and water thing. Let's raise a Vintage Beer for that real thing only you do.
100% real beer for real people. Not for sale to persons under 18. Drink responsibly.
Welcome back. It's 5 o'clock on the dot. And if you just tuned in, this is Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. And today's discussion here on Home Run concerns Algeria, one country in North Africa. It's in not Nigeria, Algeria. Not Niger. Niger, different country. Nigeria, different country. Algeria, different country. The one with a flag like the one for the United States.
Huh?
Right.
Who?
Algeria. No, that's Liberia. Now here I'm mixing them up. See, so they.
Yeah, I thought you were talking about Malaysia's flag. I was like, huh?
No, Liberia also. That's where they copied the, you know, actually the influence was deep. So
but Malaysia's flag is similar to the US one. It's just the obvious, what do you call it? The obvious, what do you call that? The crescent moon.
Uh-huh.
With a star.
Oh, yeah. They have a crescent moon, except, you know, the US one only has stars.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so we have Niger, you have Nigeria, you have Algeria and Liberia on the same continent. Now, what we're talking about is Algeria. Right now, by landmass, the largest country on the continent. And it's a pretty old country, and the founding of the country can be traced back to 202 BC. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. 202 BC. A very, very, very old country. And now, obviously, like any country, like any African country, they have their own chapter of colonialism, and except for them, it was by the French. Colonialism is, you know, colonial empires they just differed in name. But the method and atrocities that, you know, the method of governing and atrocities that they left behind, you know, for us to basically talk about in terms of history, it's not very different, because they, you know, torture, well, segregation, you name it. They, you know, it was basically the same across the board.
Mm.
Yeah. Except, how do you then move on after that? Now, when you look at this, it draws a very interesting picture for countries that just, in terms of, you know, that have just achieved their independence, at least in comparison to countries like Algeria, Ghana, Nigeria, those ones that got their independence in the 60s. We just 30 plus years in. And we are looking at countries like Algeria that are 60 years after their independence, they are still trying to navigate the very tough, you know, more like, tense waters of having discussions about how do we have a conversation with France on some of these issues. And for them, last year it went straight to the root of their source, of the source of their governance, and that's the constitution. They were basically sitting and going, you know what, there's a lot of things in our constitution that does not reflect the country's history. Mm. So now you are caught in between a rock and a hard place. How do you try to move on and also at the same time not lose the part of your history that's not good? You don't want to talk about it, but it's just a part of your history. So it has to be part of you. Yeah, so you have to acknowledge it, that, well, it happened. And how do you resolve these issues now? How do you have this conversation without, you know, ending up with the one of you holding a gun and you're back to square one? And especially when you're not finding a common ground in terms of agreeing on how to have this conversation, because obviously the Algerian government wants France to. They have acknowledged, but they haven't apologized. They haven't offered a formal apology. But the Algerian government wants them to do that. So here we are. And even when it comes to these whole amendments, the French were not very happy. The French government was not happy with the amendments, especially with some of the words, with how some of the words were, were defined, or more like changed from the old to the new. Now, one of those things that took my attention from there was the The crimes also includes subjecting Algerians to exceptional laws, practicing physical and psychological torture, racial discrimination. That sounds like apartheid South Africa. Mm. And inhuman treatment, deliberate denial of fundamental rights. Palestine, Israel, same WhatsApp group. Now you have fundamental rights, exile, illegal deportation of civilians to the mountains and arid, regions, and the confiscation of their property, because you have these portions of land that are very arable, because you have to understand that we are still in agrarian, for the most part, era here.
Yep.
Yeah. So, arable land was very lucrative. So if you can just, get rid of everyone that is occupying the land that you want to farm on, move them away, and then you can just claim that property as your, that property as your own. Now, you obviously don't want to move people from a piece of arable land to another piece of arable land, because then you'll have to retake it again. So you just have to take them to a part that is least arable. Now, that's condemning people to starvation. So, that's one of those things that basically the Algerian government was looking at. And now, kidnapping and enforced disappearance. Well, you can just do the math on that one. Detentions outside the framework of the law. Now that's the part that made me go like, outside the law. We're talking about colonial law. What do you mean outside the confines of the law?
Because obviously their law didn't exist yet.
Exactly. Yeah. Because if by colonial laws were just as brutal, we had them here. Which is interesting, because every time that I read about people like Idi Amin and Central African Republic's Napoleon blown apart. There's one Somalian guy that came on TikTok and said, if I was a rapper, if I was a world leader, what nickname? What would my name be? Someone said Napoleon blown apart. The comment section is brutal. Now,
blown apart.
Yeah. That's creative.
People have no filter.
Every time that I read the history of people like Jean Bedel Bokassa and Idi Amin, and you have they have in their history them saving sometimes in Asia, in French army, in French military. I'm like, okay, these guys were being colonized. Why would they just participate in military campaigns of the guys that were colonizing them and then helping them to colonize other people? Then they were forced conscriptions, for the most part.
Well, not just that, Helmut. Here's the other thing also that the French Foreign Legion did. So those two heads of state couldn't fully be integrated into the French army. Like I mentioned, the French army themselves had issues with outsiders fighting in them.
Yeah.
It's the same situation as the British.
Actually, I would too, if that outsider is the guy I just colonized. How sure am I that they will not put a grenade in my pocket?
Oh, it's the same thing that the British did. You will not hear, for example, if you go watch movies, certain movies about certain particular British history, military history chapters, you would see just, perspectives from the British soldier, the British soldier from Britain. The Englishman, you would see their perspectives of the Second World War. But then you will hear perspectives like the guy, the one guy that one of my siblings knows from Marintal, who told my sister that his grandfather was a veteran of the North Africa theater when they pushed, what's the German general, Heinrich Himmler, the other guy, Ernst, Rommel, Erwin Rommel, when they fought against the Desert Fox. To know that, there were certain Namibians like that. I think there's a few of the liberation year
a few of the liberation stalwarts in Namibia who technically were also like Second World War veterans in some scenarios. Mm-hmm. They were men who were conscripted under, what was that South African general? Not Louis Botha, the other guy, Smuts, Jan Smuts. Was it Smuts? But Smuts and Botha were together in the First World War. They were the guys that pushed out the Germans in Namibia in the First World War. Mm. But then there was another general that literally, a South African general that literally, conscripted from South African and from Namibian, men. And then they went to North Africa alongside the New Zealanders, alongside the Australians. Okay. The Australians were predominantly in Asia against the Japanese, but you don't hear of the history of those men.
No.
You don't hear zero. Okay. The weird thing with the French discussion was that it was the French Constitution and the French Republic that was the major concern. The rest of us were just, oh yeah, and the Kenyan soldiers as well. How the Kenyans also were sort of like part of the British and the Indians, how they were all part of the British military machine in terms of fighting against the Germans here in North Africa, the Japanese in Asia, and it was the, who was the other guys? And the Italians, in Ethiopia. The Italians and the Germans were literally like this in Africa. Because the British were sensitive about the whole of Ethiopia, Eritrea, which was Abyssinia,
yeah,
falling to the Italians, and the British are in Kenya. And the British were like, hello,
yeah,
why are these guys on my border? So obviously it was a point of consternation. The Germans and the Italians expanded literally into North Africa in search of oil. That's one of the biggest concerns because their military machine was growing. They were in need of oil. And at that particular scenario, Helmut, Algeria was also the center of the Vichy government, the Vichy French government. So the Vichy French, that's why I mentioned that if you've ever watched that Algerian independence movement, independence video or movie, which was made by Algerians, you will hear how the French narrative back then was like, Algeria is literally part of France. France. You cannot think of Algeria as separate of France. Algeria is part of France. And reasons being specifically because the president of the day, Charles de Gaulle, was the guy that took the whole French Navy, the whole French Air Force, now most of the French army to Algeria. They went and parked literally in Algeria, at Algiers, Navy, Air Force, everything. They parked the bus there and they said, you guys sort each other out in Europe. So the French civilians set up a civilian government that literally collaborated with the Germans, with the failed Austrian painter, which obviously made it easy for the Germans to literally take over France. Spain was obviously neutral because Spain had suffered its own civil war under Franco and the other guy, the communists. Franco was calling himself the Republicans, but Franco was literally telling the Spanish king, you know what, I'll protect you against the communists. The communists are anti-establishment. And that was where Ernest Hemingway went to fight as well against Franco as well, because they were all fighting on the side of the communist guys because the Russians were sending guns. So they were saying, hey, let's fight with Russian guns. So yeah, things were fun in the 1930s to an extent.
Yeah, they were not fun.
I know, it's a messy situation. But yeah, that's what it looked like. Oh. Most of the Africans in the French army were in the French Foreign Legion. So if you were Irish, you were Italian, you were Spanish, you were African, you were South American, you were in the French Foreign Legion. You weren't in the full
French army.
So, in other words, if you were from a colonized country,
yeah, you were in the Foreign Legion.
Boy, 15 minutes past the hour of 5. Quick break, and we'll continue on the other side. Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM.
Lipura nengelo wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kudite opoewe ekukulile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshuana onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu kwa ndado ili nawa nune uto otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka opone ushe ndife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile kumberewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do, from Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Welcome back. But before continuing, let's take a live read. Get your kicks from a ShopRite liquor shops. Smirnoff 1818 original vodka for $159 Namibian dollars and 99 cents. Harrier's whiskey and Gordon dry gin for $179 Namibian dollars and 99 cents each. KWV 3-year-old brandy for $199 Namibian dollars and 99 cents. Richelieu brandy for $189 Namibian dollars 99 cents. And J&B Scotch whiskey for just $239 Namibian dollars and 99 cents. Please don't drink and drive. ShopRite liquor shops care. So, back to Algeria. First of all, you begin to look at colonialism from a different angle. And when I was going through this, it took me back to, you know, to the conversation, I think, a show you had on your Sunday morning take that was on Haiti. Haiti again, it's the French. Now, if you look at how Haiti was basically treated and back then, which basically sort of like put Haiti on a very terrible economic trajectory, which is why they're struggling to this day. They were occupied. They fought for their own liberation, and the only way of giving it to them was, if they acknowledge that, all those slaves that freed themselves must now start paying property, former masters over the loss of that property. Now, that points to me at one thing that is more often not talked about in colonialism, not just in Haiti or Algeria, but just colonialism all across the board. A private interest is nowhere near as mentioned. I don't think it's emphasized enough when it comes to the influence that it has. Every time we talk about colonialism, we like to talk about it, we like to think about it mostly in terms of territorial expansion and power. And that's it. But the thing is, there's a lot of resources that's acquired, and most of that resource, it's mostly heavily, either directly or indirectly, influenced by private interest. One of the reasons why it took Belgium for a very long time to acknowledge what Leopold did, in DRC, is because they kept saying that was Leopold's private property. It had nothing to do with the government at the time.
Which is the biggest concern?
Yeah,
I mean, Hamoud, if I can show you, if I ever had the opportunity of showing you, but I keep forgetting to show you. The same time that the Belgian king went to DRC, that was last year, right?
I think it was last year.
Or was it 2024?
Yeah.
The same time also the Dutch king and queen went to say sorry in Cape Town. They went to Cape Town, it was the whole thing. Two polar opposites happened.
The Belgian king was welcomed by Felix Tshisekedi, was given a parade and all that, and he made his speech and, you know, stuff like that, and that Belgian king went back to Belgium.
Yeah.
The Dutch king and queen wanted to literally immerse themselves in everyday South African life to say, to apologize for the Dutch colonial past that obviously still lingers over the Western Cape and much of South Africa. I don't want to replay or actually reenact the negative reaction that the Dutch king and queen got.
Oh yeah.
Because they were insulted, they were sworn at, they various phrases of foul language was hurled at them. Because the news crews were obviously there with their cameras and stuff. And it was, in some scenarios, it was bad. Because here's the thing, Hamoud, that literally the British just inherited also from the Dutch. The British inherited a sort of like a halfway point in terms of, firstly bringing in slaves from all across the world to a place, to the African continent that is not indigenous to these people.
Yeah.
And these are the descendants of people that you now would find in many parts of South Africa, like the Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, the Eastern Cape as well. And that's what the British and the Dutch did. They shuffled populations around. If the indigenous population died out, it's the same thing that the Germans wanted to do. They obviously, you know, sort of like massacre out the indigenous population. That was not the first instance of resistance. Mm-hmm. Same thing that happened in South Africa. Because there's actually a second book after the book that I'm currently still reading, known as The Land Wars. I actually forgot I bought this book, Helmut. So the book that I'm starting with is the, what's the book's name by Patrick Tarik Mallet. Okay. So I've got that first particular book that I've started with. After that one is another historical book that looks into the wars before the British came to South Africa, or before the British literally took the Western Cape settler post from the Dutch. That there were literally campaigns that the Dutch and French settlers had waged against local indigenous population groups.
Okay, so in these South were Africa. Not just like tribal wars. These were
nope. This was literally as the, you know, obviously the kinds of agrarian policy that was pushed obviously in the colony territories.
Yeah,
was not obviously something that was seen literally. The Dutch realized, hey, listen, seems like the Western Cape and the surrounding areas around the Western Cape, around Table Mountain, has the best potential for growing fresh produce.
Yeah.
And the sailors, specifically the Dutch East India Company, which was the number one, the world's biggest ever company. I'll say it again. I did that talk on my Sunday morning talk. The world's biggest ever company that has existed in the history of the human race. Dear listeners, the Dutch East India Company. Guess who's number two? The British East India Company. Both of these companies were so big. Individually, Apple, Google, Meta, what's his name's company? Tesla. And there's another one that I'm missing. Even in Nvidia. Separately, none of them come close to those two companies that existed in human history. Together, they would at least come close to the British East India Companies overall.
Not the Dutch East India.
Not even the Dutch East India Company. Together, those companies could come close to the British East India Companies, the wealth it had at that time. So, okay.
Now, because you're looking, I think we haven't learned a thing here. Because when you let a private interest grow that big, because the Dutch East India Company, didn't those guys have their own private military?
Yes, so did the British East India.
Exactly. Now, when you have private armies, when you have private companies having private armies, you have to understand when something is private. For the most part, if not all the time, it's for profit.
Definitely. And it's to protect interests.
Yeah, to protect interests. And that's how actually, that's literally the history of colonialism. You have to, protect interest. You either have to convince a bunch of guys in parliament to send in the military, that's the country's military, or if you are rich enough like the Dutch and the British East India Company, you can send in your own army. And the best example of that would be what's going on, in Iran right now. When does it start? 1953. How does it start? It involves interest, private interest, private interest.
Whose interest? British.
Yeah, of course it goes. It's always the British, I swear.
And you know what's even a sad thing, Helmut? What was the guy's name? The one TV host who said, "Where do you want me to start with context? Do you want me to start in the 70s when the revolution happened? Or do you want me to start literally when the first overthrow and the installation of the religious leader began literally after Mossadegh's? Or the installation of the Shah? It was first the Shah.
Yeah.
That was installed after Mossadegh. And many people still till today approach a discussion as if today Helmut kicked Dwight.
This one bombed that guy. I mean, this whole thing must have started this year. No, it didn't. And a lot of Westerners, for the most part, and I think that's largely, and I'm with Julian Assange on this one. That's largely propagated by the media.
Yeah.
And that's, the Iranians in 1979 overthrew the Shah because they hate the Western way of life. No! They had a dictator imposed on them. They hated the guy. That's why they overthrew him. It's not that they wanted to, they hated the Western miniskirts. Not that. It's the leader they had a problem with.
And
it's a leader that was imposed on them.
They can't even prove that particular narrative.
They hate our way of life.
Yeah.
No, some idiot on CNN was saying that.
No, because they can't prove it.
They can't prove it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The same to the thing with what happened with Afghanistan. Before, who was it before? I mean, up until the 70s, Afghanistan had a certain way of life. Literally where it literally had a way of women had more rights than they have today. They could go to schools, they could do certain things, but it was because Afghanistan had those separate sort of like governing, if you think about our governors in each of their regions,
yeah.
You think of them as like a nobility. And then they had like this loose structure in terms of that these governors had to negotiate, had to sort of like work with the local tribal leaders to maintain law and order and all that. And then obviously, the religious guys popped up and the religious guys were like,
we'll take it from here.
God is great, Hawa. Mm-hmm. And then they went like, and they just took it from there. And then the Soviets then showed up and said, "Hey, listen, we feel like you guys need a little bit of communism in your life. And, you need to be consolidated into our particular, neighborhood of things.
Of governing.
We
know better. Plus we are the big guys on the block.
You guys are just, you are ripe for Soviet colonialism." And then all those tribal leaders ganged together with assistance from the CIA and they became, firstly, the front was known as the Mujahideen. And from the Mujahideen, you have Al-Qaeda popping up and you've got the Taliban popping up. And now things literally fly into the other direction from there.
Now, is history like that is why I think every time that we talk about colonialism, we don't talk enough about just how much private interest played a very big role in this.
Yeah.
Because most of these companies are still, some of them like BP, for example, they just changed their name from Anglo-Iranian to British Petroleum.
Yeah.
At least now they're being honest because the Anglo-Iranian part was just a lot of crap, which is what led to the...
ShopRite's price round down is here for 1 week only, where saving is winning. Save up to 40% on homeware, small appliances, outdoor and groceries. Like 24-liter Essentials Mini Oven, only $900 Namibian dollars. and 470 mils freehand colored base can-shaped glass for only 15 Namibian dollars each. Offers valid until 15 March 2026. Only at ShopRite.
But it's about...
Say that again. Say that again.
Yeah.
A very nice comment.
Okay. Yeah. So off, off the mic, guys, I asked Helmut, why can't the British and the Americans and the French leave the Middle East alone? Obviously, what we obviously now see, what everyone has pointed to, it's primarily to protect Israel in many cases. But in many scenarios, it always just boils down to something else.
Okay. Here's the thing. Europeans.
Yeah.
Europeans are very good at pretending like they hate Arabs and Islam, but they actually really love Arab and Islam. First of all, they decided to set up a country in the middle of a land they did not want to be associated with, and they just never get out.
A land also that the British was somehow just supervising.
Are you kidding me? They mediated the whole thing. They were the class captain.
Because, no, they took most Palestine was from the Ottomans.
The Ottomans, yeah.
Yeah. The Ottomans were most in charge of everything. And the Ottomans were saying, hey, listen, Isha, it's our way or no one's way, Isha.
The Ottomans were just
So you guys listen to us. And everybody had to just live
their life. To some degree, safe to say the Ottomans inspired the British.
They did have treaties.
Yeah.
They did have a lot of particular sort of like things going for them because the British had certain interests because of Egypt in the Middle East and also because of Kenya and because the British and the French had most jointly gone and built the Suez Canal. But then things seems to not sit right, Helmut. I mean, we would be sitting hundreds of kilometers and thousands of kilometers away from places like the UK and France and Washington in the United States, where people over there are debating and literally talking about the glorious past that Europe had, like our Munich Security Conference discussion.
Yeah, Rubio.
The glorious past that Europe had. Now, glorious past for who? Is it glorious past? Is it glorious past to say to the victims, literally us, Africa, who in 1999 decided to set up the Algiers Declaration, but only one country, a whole quarter century later, 25 years later, is now deciding, let me now enact on that 1999 declaration. Because that's what Algeria is doing.
Yeah.
So now, do you remember the speech that Rubio gave when they panned the camera to the audience?
The Munich Security Conference discussion.
Remember, do you remember the faces that all the Europeans had? It was like, what is this guy saying?
Yeah, because
they were like all shocked, sitting like, what is this guy saying?
Clearly, you haven't read our history.
This guy clearly doesn't know that the EU is trying to sort of like live the best of its life with
trying to make amends here, dude.
Specifically with Africa. Primarily because there are three guys in the EU cluster that has a negative history with Africa. Specifically the Dutch.
The British.
The British are not part of the EU. They must be outside.
Yeah, they're
not, but now they're trying to find their ways back. They're way back in. But the British is most the other one.
Yeah.
Because they, Helmut,
there's the French in there.
You can literally see time is against Europe. With regards to the discussion on colonialism.
Yeah.
African presidents, yes, them being politicians, them being voted in, they will smile, they will show the cordial, they will show the protocol behavior at every turn and event, but there will come where the African presidents will also go like, you know what, brah? My people don't forget the stuff you've committed.
Exactly.
Even today, Helmut, even in the Namibian context today, A slight update in that regard. I came across an update on my social media timeline because I favor Facebook more than Instagram because Instagram is just rubbish. I'm sorry, whoever's an Instagram fan, Instagram is rubbish.
The thing about
LinkedIn is also rubbish.
I don't even
know. LinkedIn is just
is just everyone's vanity everywhere. Yeah. Corporate vanity on another. But still. With Facebook, you know, you're still in your millennial, you know, comfort zone. Since I'm a millennial. Yeah. You too, Helmut. You're also a millennial.
Yeah.
So, came across a particular update. So, and I think I mentioned this back on Friday as well, but it's the second diplomat in the German embassy, I think it's the Charge d'Affaires or something else, speaking about the wonderful diplomatic relations between Namibia and Germany. And I said that, it's a fellow radio station that had him as a guest. And I sit there going like, under what context is this diplomat saying this particular statement? Primarily because you cannot say a sentence as ignorant as that without ignoring the unsatisfied discussion, the unsatisfied topic,
mm-hmm.
Specifically about Namibia and Germany's history regarding Namibia's particular colonial chapter, which is a history, Helmut, that in one way or another doesn't get satisfied even in the National Assembly level. First and foremost, the National Assembly guys don't know how to tackle certain issues. And I'll say it here today. I mean, there's a reason specifically why the ruling party just goes and says no. You know, with their majority in the House, mm-hmm. where they say no, you guys clearly, because you can see the opposition parties don't have a clue for dealing with international relations or how to approach international relations. They wish to approach it. And yes, in many cases, it's about political theatrics.
Every opposition right now is going, ouch.
No, but they don't know it. They literally don't. How much you can look at them?
Yeah.
If I tell you, bruh, go and look at the on a Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday session. The kinds of questions that, remember the subject matter about the one MP that wanted to sort of like, champion a piece of legislation dictating to private or to radio stations in the country to play only Namibian music. But here's the discussion. What if it's a radio station like Eagle FM who doesn't play local music during the week? So that particularly means...
Or any
music during the week. Must we now be scraped under or sort of like be combed under the same comb just because one MP or politician has one harebrained idea, mad scientist idea in their own specific scenario without actually going to the market, observing the market, making an informed decision about the market, since we are now asking the politicians... try to make data-related, data-informed decisions.
Yeah.
And then you go and propose something. Which is literally the kinds of conversations that are still taking place in this country. People go make statements. People go and entertain certain particular media platforms. And yes, I mean, it's about time, Helmut, for example, we also analyze the kind of media narrative in this country, because
political correctness is the problem I have with with politics, and this is very true in both domestic and foreign policy of basically every country.
Yeah,
I feel like these guys are too diplomatic in most of their conversations.
Who?
Politicians.
Our the ruling party politicians or the opposition?
No, politicians just the world over.
No, but that's must now for them, Helmut, the theatrics that they must put up here.
Hence the theatric description of it.
Because what I found out from a conversation that Mark Carney last week, the Canadian guy, went to Australia.
Yeah.
He was asked by another guy in a sort of like a stage discussion about, you know, his visit to Putin and his visit to Narendra Modi to India and to China and to India. Because he visited China and India right after each other. Modi and Xi.
Modi or Putin and Xi?
No, not Putin. Sorry, because I corrected. It was India
and
China.
And then Australia.
No, yeah, and then Australia. So and this is after the World Economic Forum in January.
Yeah.
He's visited India and China in between. He explained that with President Xi,
she, when the high, these two high level politicians talk to each other behind closed doors, she explains to Carney, listen, don't try and preach to me in public. You know, the things that Donald Trump does and that some other Western leaders.
So just for optics.
Yeah. Don't try to do the theatrics first out there. And then you want,
come here and you're doing,
and then you want to propose the idea in the theatrics out here to me. Rather, let's first have our honest discussion as two international leaders. And then we can have the optics outside.
Yeah.
So first start with here, then there. Obviously, it's a manner in which you sometimes also try to control a situation.
Look, I totally understand that, I totally understand that take, because the opposite would be pure entertainment.
Yeah. Modi did the same thing when Carney went to visit Modi. Modi explained to him, don't start with the theatrics there and then say, me and India must do what and do this and do. And then when you get here, it's a different discussion. You're playing lame duck, or you're playing this very friendly person, persona here in front of me. Rather, let's have the private discussion first. Let's be honest and open. Mm-hmm. Let's be frank as two leaders of countries, and let's get to the real nitty gritties in negotiation. And then you can have the theatrics outside.
Yeah.
Which obviously speaks to the way in which the big powerhouse economies in the global south wants to literally tell the global north, the established, the developed global north guys, you know what? Your politics is not our politics. Your way of doing things is not our way of doing things. Yeah. Now, which also, in a way, how much you can see cascades into the Algeria-France discussion. Because the Algerians are saying, listen, or the Algerian president said this, which is now somehow also being channeled by the National Assembly guys, who said, listen, try to emulate through this piece of legislation, this constitutional rework, what the President Tebboune said in 2024. They're not seeking money, but France must literally somehow atone for what they caused in Algeria. Because Algeria is a major oil and gas exporter in North Africa. It's actually already selling to Europe.
Thank you for bringing us back to a private interest.
Yeah.
Major oil exporter. According to, the only source, interesting enough, and I could find, and this is, I just started looking at this somewhere around two. The only source I could find that sort of like addresses in detail how colonialism, or basically every type of expansion, is tied to private interest. But then when the history is written on that subject, private interest is almost always left out.
Mm.
The only source I could find was Taylor and Francis, like one of your biggest online libraries. They basically did, they have a whole article on it, but there's just two parts that I would like to read to you. The initial process of colonization in the world were undertaken by private companies that were given charters to explore, to seek profit, and obtain land while also making claims for jurisdiction sovereignty in the name of various European monarchs, as well as the Pope. Now, because this takes you back to the Spanish and the Portuguese with the doctrine of discovery.
Yeah.
Now, the fact is, when we read about guys like, like Diego Cao, Bartolomeo Diaz, you have guys like, Christopher Columbus, those voyages were not cheap. They required a lot of money.
Mm.
And most governments did not have that money. Private interest funded them, obviously, for them to have a take after whatever that was, quote unquote, discovered and quote unquote collected.
Mm. And quote unquote then owned.
Yeah, and then quote unquote then owned. So all these explorations were not cheap, which is why before any of this, Christopher Columbus and who is this, Bartolomeo Diaz even reached here, there's a reason why, you know, there's a reason why Zheng He, the Chinese general and explorer. Now, I think that was during the Ming Dynasty. They had to stop his exploration because they were insanely expensive. But
and his ships were like three times the size of the Spanish ship.
They were giants.
And the Portuguese ships.
He had a whole armada. He reached Somalia before the Portuguese came here. So
wasn't he already at Mozambique, Helmut?
So Somalia and Mozambique.
Yeah.
Now the thing is, well, if colonialism, I think, was the end goal, I think the Chinese would have colonized us.
Yeah, they would have.
Yeah. I wonder what my Chinese Christian name would be. Because
of not Hermuta. Just letting you know.
To be says in Xinhuan. That'd be nice. Now, colonial influence would be awesome. Now, look, you have to understand, I have Helmut because of European colonialism.
Because of the Bible.
Because of European colonialism.
Yeah.
If it was a Chinese colonialism, obviously I would have a Chinese name. Would it be awesome?
Well, it's actually weird, Helmut, because the only, if you actually look at colonialism from an Asian perspective, the only true colonizers in an Asian perspective, and this is now, we are obviously playing in a devil's advocate role here.
Pure devil's advocate, yeah.
In terms of looking at who would have been the best evil to conquer,
Africa. Don't bring in the Japanese. No,
it wouldn't have been the Japanese. But the Japanese had a self-isolationist policy, meaning
they liked meddling in other people's affairs.
No, it was a discussion of no foreigners on Japan.
But they were everywhere in Asia.
No.
Also not,
Albert.
And how do you explain Manchuria?
Okay, no. I'm talking about pre-1900.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah. So, and I'm going literally back to that Chinese general that sailed all the way up to Mozambique and then turned back.
Yeah.
The only actual true colonizers from an Asian perspective were the Mongols.
Oh, no, those guys were something
else. And the Mongols were literally sheep herders, farmers, nomadic. And if it wasn't
no
for...
No wonder they were that good of horse riders.
If it wasn't for Genghis Khan, then you would not have had the surname Khan spanning from China literally into Germany. You get the surname Khan.
In German?
Yes. The German Khan is written clever. They swapped the A and the H. But how the surname is written is must KH.
Yeah.
But if you find the German Khan, it's written AH. So it's KAH. But you still get to the same pronunciation.
Yeah.
And then you ask yourself, okay, so where did you get the Khan in this situation? And then it's literally the same surname, but obviously to, you know, do away with any Mongolian roots or sort of like background. The Mongols were, I mean, the easiest route for them was coming through Russia.
Yeah.
And coming through Russia, they obviously had, and this is literally during the period of when the Holy Roman Empire split into two, you had the East and the West, and this was during the Byzantine era, and at that stage, Europe didn't know where Europe was.
It's always important to emphasize that the holy part was very,
because
it's very debatable,
considering
what they did with the holy title attached to the empire.
Or how they dispense the holiness of anything. So
they were baptizing people in the name of the sword.
And it was at that stage that Christianity was still trying to find its roots in Europe.
Yeah.
Or find a grounding in Europe, because obviously Christianity couldn't find a grounding in the Middle East, even though it was born in the Middle East.
Yeah.
So the Byzantine Empire, which was the Holy Roman Eastern Empire, they tried through, that's just where the Orthodox Christians come from. They tried with that kind of a...
Yeah, they literally built the Hagia Sophia.
Yeah. And if you go now to the city that is now known as Istanbul, but its old name was Constantinople. If you go to Constantinople, what is that massive mosque that was a cathedral?
It's Hagia Sophia, the Church of Holy Wisdom.
The Hagia, yeah, the Hagia Sophia. So the Hagia Sophia was literally a cathedral. Now, the Mongols by then...
Church of Holy Wisdom. Those guys were very good at finding names.
Because literally, the guys that were sort of like the bad news bears in the neighborhood of Europe were the Mongols that were coming through Russia. They kept coming through Russia in terms of like, it was the easiest sort of like way to cross.
Yeah.
And they, you know, I mean, they had various names, but they all were the same sort of like people. And it's just that they were led by different kinds of warlords. But this was the particular scenario, the history that in many cases people think it's like, ugh, you know, it's there. It's 2,000 years in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that 2,000-year discussion that Africa is also now trying to sort out. Because here's the biggest question, Helmut. Yes, okay, let's forget the 2,000-year discussion of human history. Let's look at the immediate late colonialism history that places like Africa, places like Algeria and Namibia are trying to sort out. Algeria suffered 132 years of colonialism.
Yeah.
Namibia suffered in a span of 20 to 30 years of German colonialism. The rest obviously was through South African colonialism.
Yeah.
But South African colonialism also just happened at a bend. The role that the South African colonialism played a part was like at a, we make Namibia livable. We build roads, we build schools, we install the basics, we make it livable. And then the rest, we just police.
Yeah.
So this meant Namibia was set up to be extracted from.
Yeah.
By the South Africans. The Germans were doing the same. But if you go to a place like Abanap, which is today a lodge on a, which is a farm technically, but if you look at that, that scale of innovation and investment on that mine that is now that has been decommissioned for 100 years, more than 100 years, Helmut, they connected that farm, that place to Tsumeb. And they couldn't, which was literally 20 kilometers in one direction heading westwards. And to Grootfontein, which is another 50 kilometers heading eastwards. With an underground, not railway, but with railway tracks. Yeah, an underground railway system. In Namibia.
How many kilometers?
20 heading to Tsumeb. And 30 heading to Grootfontein. Or 50. Yeah, 50 max heading to Grootfontein.
Underground.
Underground, Helmut.
Ah.
So, the level of...
Are those tunnels still open?
No. Some of the ones that we ended up, because Dwight Wint was in there, with his cell phone, and I didn't take out the camera to snap photos. But the thing is also, we were like in such poorly lit, scenarios of the tunnels. The guide explained to us literally that the tracks that we were standing, in the one direction you could go to,
they expand 30 kilometers that way and
Tsumeb, another direction you can go to Grootfontein, underground. That mine had an underground prison, an underground jail, an underground, medical facility, an underground, magistrate. An underground, sort of like.
Jeez.
They had almost everything. And this was all German run, the company. And then the company was sold to South African outfit. And I think by 1950 something or 1960 something, they had to close the mine because they were digging too close to the
water table.
To the water table. And that's as the lowest level we ended up. We were told that literally there's like another 50 meters. Before you get to the lowest level of the mine, of the mine shaft. Now ask yourself the question, Helmut. Already in 1890s, when that thing was installed, they already had the capability of connecting two other mining towns to this one mine.
Underground tunnel.
And guess what? It's a mineral that literally hardens steel and any other alloy or any other metal. Sorry, not alloy.
5 minutes to the hour of 6, Home Run with Helmut and Dwight. Before we continue, let's take a live read. Get your kicks from a ShopRite liquor shops, a Smirnoff 1818 original vodka for $159.99. Harry's Whiskey and Gordon, a dry gin for $179.99 each. KWV, a 3-year-old brandy for $199.99. Rich Liu brandy for $189.99. And J&B Scotch Whiskey for just $239.99. Please don't drink and drive. ShopRite liquor shops care. Now, I'm connecting the whole private interest discussion and colonialism for a reason. It's because until we basically address the problem, colonialism in a way that it's studied in school, it's mostly looked at from the political point of view. We never really look at it from what were the economic motivations or the economic incentives that came out of this, came out of this chaos for us. It was exploration for them, but it disrupted a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ways of life culturally, ways of life basically spiritually, a lot of things were disrupted. One that you just pointed out the other day, what's this, traditional ways of brewing beer. That's slowly becoming a lost art. Why? It's because, someone showed up with their own method and said, set aside yours and just adopt mine. Now, you can just look at that if you have, if you are one of those that look at down on everything that's native, you can look at that and say, you know what, but this one is more superior.
Mm.
No, it's not. It's just being refined. Any method of brewing can be refined.
Yep.
But, again, here we are. The Francis and Taylor guys on the whole private interest in colonialism also points out that the first stage of capitalism then, I would suggest the author writes here, is that is better understood simply as colonialism through private property. That is transformation of land, labor into property, into commodities through process of appropriation, possession, and enslavement. So always follow the money.
Mm.
Everything that takes place on a global stage, there's a lot of money involved. And colonialism is one of those things. It wasn't just a bunch of European guys that just decided they were tired of feeling cold, they wanted to go to a place hot, and then they came straight to Africa. No, there's a lot of economic incentives behind it. And the exploration themselves were not cheap.
Mm.
And that, these were investments like any other. And they really paid off when Christopher Columbus got lost and landed himself in what would be known as the Americas. Because that made the Spanish super wealthy. They claimed the whole area. Anyone that, they went there to steal stuff, but they did not want anyone else to join them in the stealing.
You should read on the mad search that the Spanish went on, looking for the seven cities of gold.
Oh Jesus! The whole myth and legends.
You should read that story.
Hens El Dorado.
I did it here on my Sunday morning take. I was like, it's literally as how colonialism began, and that's the early forms of colonialism. People saying, you know what, Helmut and Dwight, they've got houses made out of gold. And literally, the asset forfeiture department guys come.
You know what? We've got to find these
houses. We've got to find these houses full of gold. Just to find that maybe you put on new corrugated iron on as a roof. Instead of having a thatch roof.
Yeah.
And that was literally the situation that happened. But yeah,
ShopRite's price rounddown is here for 1 week only, where saving is winning. Save up to 40% on homeware, small appliances, outdoor and groceries. like 20-liter Essentials black or white manual microwave oven, only 800 Namibian dollars each, and 12-piece Spring Flower or Finesse white dinner set for only 199 Namibian dollars per set. Offers valid until 15 March 2026, only at ShopRite.
Welcome back. It's 6 o'clock on the dot. Now, just to wrap it up, here's one thing I find fascinating. And that is wherever colonial expansion went to, whether you are looking at Africa, South America, Australia, when you look at it, most of the things that were taken, especially land, it's in private hands. So you're telling me government expansion somehow turned around and went private. So these are the guys that basically...
Which it actually did.
Yeah.
It actually did, Helmut. You are right.
So, we are looking at it mostly, you know, mostly from a political standpoint. Because you can't tell me that it was just the British or the French, it was just the British that expanded in Australia, or it was just the French government, just the political aspect of things. The French government expanded into Algeria. And then, somehow the land and the natural resources ended up being extracted by private interests. I'm like, okay. The meth is not meting somewhere here. So most of the, you know, just like getting to public office, a lot of people that want to get back to public office are too broke to fund their own campaign. And then they are funded. That's the most painful part about politics. It's very pathetic. There's a lot of people that want to be in public office.
Or they become pastors.
Exactly. A lot of people that want to make their way into public office don't have money to fund for their own campaign. So they seek private help, which is not illegal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Political parties in Namibia are allowed to source their own, you know, private funding, as long as they are not doing it from guys like M23. Then we are not allowed to get money from those, even if they have it in buckets. Now, the reason why I kept saying basically all throughout the show that we are not talking about private interest, the influence of colonialism and how it basically funded the whole thing is you can look at the Dutch East India Company, for example. This is a private company that grew so big it had its own army. And I think we should have learned from then that allowing private companies that are, you know, companies that are driven by profit and expansion to grow to the point where they have their own army is a bad idea, because they start challenging all sovereign nations. And right now we have a lot of private military contractors that are just running around trigger happy, and they are not offering allegiance to any flag. They're willing to fight on the side of anyone who is willing to pay.
Do you know what's the saddest thing, Amut? Where you can see a reiteration of literally that,
yeah,
is in the video game Resident Evil.
Oh.
About the Umbrella Corporation.
Yeah. Oh, the Umbrella Corporation is one empire that was basically... that's private company with unchecked power.
Yeah. Selling bio-warfare to one government and selling it to the other government and selling it to both enemies and allies.
Alike.
Didn't care. So, yeah. And that's...
Today, that's in software.
That too, yeah.
You have a lot of software-making companies, or some of them are just making straight-up dictatorship-friendly. Making them is not a problem. But the thing is, when everything is driven by profit, you are going to sell it to anyone with money, and more often, dictators have money.
Mm. More than they should have.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And they will buy these things, and if you want to guess what they're going to be using them for?
Obviously, to reinforce their position.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's some of the sort of like lesser good of what's happening. Now, here's the thing, Helmut. Back in last year when we did the discussion about the vice president's particular take on the theme for Africa of last year, that obviously being the reparations and colonialism discussion subject matter. Vice President Witbooi made a surprising statement last year at that Open Society engagement, where she cited that it seems like some of the other African countries are taking a cue from Namibia. Now, taking a cue and obviously being sort of like a pioneer and a conversation point is two different things, because at one stage, you know, Namibia looked, we looked like a country that was literally standing up and saying, listen, we've got this. Yeah, we've really got to talk about this, and specifically approaching Germany about this particular subject matter, which in its own right, also has certain particular aspects which need to be entertained, because, and this is one of the things that I've observed since 2020, when the joint declaration came about or emerged after the negotiations during COVID, was why does it feel like the whole joint declaration discussion was negotiated in secrecy or under wraps, even though we knew of the envoy and his team being sent from Namibia to Germany. But the discussion was still, you know, why wasn't there sort of like a transparency discussion in terms of, firstly, what do people want?
Like stakeholder engagement.
Stakeholder engagement, assessing the stakeholder engagement, and then going off to the discussion, because the reason being, Helmut, there are so many people that are impacted. And even if you look at it just from the two extermination orders, which cites only two groups in the country, there are so many more people who were at one stage due to, let's say, what's that thing's name? Heritage, through heritage, or through, what's the other word that exists? The one through, you know.
And I have to hurry up. David is about to kill us.
Yeah. Through DNA affiliation or some sort, you know, in one way or another,
yeah,
does have a descendant, meaning they do have a dog in this fight, or they do have a claim in this fight that probably were from one of the two groups, that you can literally highlight a discussion to say, listen, there are so much more people that are impacted on this conversation. It's not just a cut and dry thing. You literally have a massive stakeholder engagement. Now, be that as it may, what you will obviously see now and today in 2026 in Namibia, we're seeing literally the actual thing that many of the proponents of the groups back in 2021 and 2020 cited was, don't dress it up like development aid, or don't dress it up like development stuff, which is obviously probably also the thing
that
Algeria also probably is citing to, but Algeria is not saying as much. That they're not saying as much, because I mean, to say that you don't want
money,
but
then just want an apology.
You just want the apology. How does that actually happen?
It doesn't make sense. Especially if on one side, on an AU level, you are saying,
It literally stands there. Let's have reparations. There's a line there.
That brings us to the end of today's Home Run. Thank you for tuning in wherever you are tuned in from. And if you are in the Middle East, please just follow the International Relations Ministry, instruction here at home and the nearby embassies. And I understand it's Egypt. We have got to do better. But
first question would be, what were you doing there?
Opportunity. Yeah, believe me.
I know, Helmut, I know.
I know.
I just had to ask really the painful. Obvious question.
It's also a very painful reminder for a lot of African leaders that are now scrambling to get their people out of that region, because they shouldn't have gotten there in the first place if what they went there for was provided at home. Painful reminder. 9 minutes into the hour of 6, that brings us to the end of Home Run for today. Until tomorrow, same time, same place, on your favorite radio station, Eagle FM. From me, y'all have a blessed evening.
Let's see each other again, same time, same place, guys. Stay tuned for the next program after the break.